Nobody covers dog sledding like Mushing from First Paw Media. Our team of athletes, volunteers, race organizers, and mushers like Robert and Michelle Forto brings you closer to the sport. If it's happening, we are there. Live from the qualifying races in January and February, the Iditarod in March, and in the summer, Mushing takes you on the road with our team and trail tour. We connect you with a history of the sport, in-depth interviews with the top mushers, and great storytelling and breaking news all year long. Follow on Mushing.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert, and you're listening to the Mushing Podcast. And I'm welcoming back Rod Perry. This is episode 4 of our series together. If you have not heard the other episodes, I highly encourage you to go back because it leads up to where we are at today. Rod, how's it going?
Well, it's going very, very well. And I'm enthusiastic about our project here.
Likewise, and as we're recording this, it looks like the 2026 Iditarod finish is upon us. I know just yesterday that the first expedition musher crossed under the arch, and I'm going to bring that up here in a little bit. But as we said in our last three episodes, we are sort of meandering down through your history in the sport of dog mushing, and here we are today, almost 50 years since you ran in the Iditarod. Can you catch us up to speed? Tell our listeners what you're doing now and what you're all about in those current roles.
Okay. I have always, you know, held Iditarod close to my heart. And of course, the main reason behind inspiration for the Iditarod, I have to explain over and over every day to the walk-ups to my downtown kiosk, which is the Mushing District's historical interpretation kiosk. I have to explain to all of these people who think that inspiration came from the Serum Run that it was not, that it was the plight of the sled dogs in the bush. They were disappearing at a high rate of speed, and something dramatic had to be done to save the remnants. And so anyway, I've always had the good of the sled dogs at heart. And right now I am writing a chapter for the second edit of my volume 2 of Trail Breakers Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod, which was about founding the last great race on earth. And this chapter has to do with saving the sled dogs. And so that's been a big one. Let's see, I should go way, way back. After the first race, a number of us gathered out in Galena. Sydney Huntington out there put us up. And for 2 or 3 days, we went over the race rules. they were so minimal. Dick Mackey pretty much wrote them out on a napkin at the old Kashim restaurant up in Wasilla. One page mimeographed. We went over those and made suggestions. We also decided to form a Mushers Club for finishers, and it was not called the IOFC, Iditarod Official Finishers Club. That was a renaming that came many years later. It was, if you look at the patch that I created, the name of the club was Anchorage to Nome Iditarod Mushers. And so anyway, I went about designing and producing what became the iconic patch of the North, the Mushers patch. And by the way, the Nazarene minister up in Nome took a picture of me coming in on the sea ice on the first Iditarod, and I used that as a model for the musher with the dog team. So anyway, did that. Let's see, coming in for that 1977 race from where I had been training out at Lake Minchumina, And for those who don't know, if you were to fly directly from Fairbanks to McGrath on a deadline and about halfway out, jump out of the plane, you'd land in the middle of the biggest lake in interior Alaska, Lake Minchumina. Back then, there was no beaten trail out to the highway. By the route we took, it was about 175 miles. It took 16 whole days and part of two others to reach the highway. And of course, all the supplies had to be carried on the sled. I looked the route over from the air the day before I left, and I saw a trapline trail. I was debating on which way to go to get out to the highway, and my preferred route, we were looking that over, and all of a sudden, bingo, there's a trapline trail down there going exactly the way I wanted to go if I could just hit it. And on day 10, after following a very careful compass course, very carefully, bingo, hit the trail, and that trail led us to the trapper. We had broken a piece on my big sled, and with that huge load, I needed that sled to be working in all of its parts. The trapper repaired that break, and he said he had never, ever been on a dog sled. I said, Leroy, you're one of the founders of the Alaska Trappers Association. You live in Fairbanks, this dog ranch area. You've been in Alaska a little longer than I have, and you've never been on a dog sled? Well, tomorrow let's fix that, Leroy. Let's have you perch up on my load as I leave, and we'll give you a ride. Well, that turned out to be Leroy Shank, who a few years later turned out to be father of the Yukon Quest. Okay, so he got his start right there out on his trapline. And I'll tell you what, that repair he put on that sled, I still have on it. I wouldn't take it off for anything. I call it the birthplace of the Yukon Quest. That got him into dogs, and he ran the Iditarod a couple of times. And then he and I sat down during the winter of 83-84 and pretty much hammered out the Quest at his kitchen table with a lot of help from Roger Williams. And we took the news of the race over to White Horse, presented it to the Canadians for the first time, and got them on board. And so that was a great honor that I was able to take part in the founding of two races, actually. So let's see, I was attending meetings before the first Iditarod, a lot of the formative meetings. I was just a fly on the wall. I had a little dog team for the motion picture I was making, but I was just sitting back there and listening raptly to all the goings on. And so today there's just this tiniest handful of us that were in on it before the first Iditarod and can go way back and tell the story with what I call incontestable authenticity. About how the race was born. Well, anyway, that was part. Let's see. Also, I came back from the first race, and I wrote the first story ever written that went international in the periodical press. It was called "Mushing the Iditarod Trail," I'm pretty sure, and it turned out to be the longest two-part article in the history of Alaska Magazine. I think still is. And let's see. Oh, that caught or was brought to the attention of the Secretary of the Interior under President Carter, Cecil Andrus, and he appointed me to the very first Iditarod National Historic Trails Advisory Council. So I have quite a background in not only creation of the Iditarod race, but creation in the gold rush days of the Iditarod trail, the race runs over.
Let me jump in, Rod. Let's take you to about the mid 80s now. So you're about 10 years past Iditarod and you're working with Leroy and some others on the Quest. Did you ever run the Quest?
Never did. I've never even seen one.
Okay.
I live down in the Anchorage area in Birchwood, Chugiak here. And so what happened is I was kind of in the process of getting out of dogs.
Okay.
I'd had a life-changing experience, personal experience, and I realized I was spinning my wheels. I would earn good money in the summertime, working construction and so forth, and spend it all in the winter, you know, running dogs and so forth. And so at a point, I thought, man, I don't have a family. I don't have a business of my own. I don't have a home of my own. I'm just going nowhere on some of these priorities of mine, and I have to get away.
So let's jump over to the mid 80s to the early 2000s. You said you're working on the Iditarod Trail Commission and all of those things that you're doing. Of course, I'm sure you still have your hands in other projects in relation to dog mushing. At what point did it switch over to become sort of a historian, if you will? Of course, you know, with your booth now, I know this is where we met. You were on our podcast well over a decade ago in 2014. Let's get up to current day. What have you been doing in the last quarter century or so in regard to the sport and the lifestyle?
Okay. It's kind of like my history with wrestling. When I decided I was getting a little too old and I was getting a little, I was getting injured a lot. I just couldn't stay off the mat. If I stayed around coaching and refereeing and everything, when I left wrestling, I just left it cold turkey. I never went to a wrestling match for 12 years. Same with dog mushing. When I finished my work, I could see the Quest was ready to take off that first year. I left for a job on the slope and I started working on the slope. I stiff-armed everything to do with sled dogs and sled dog racing for about 25 years. I didn't get near it because I knew I was so passionate about it, I would just get sucked right back in. But at which time I reached what most people would call retirement age and left my fish and game work, I needed something that would drive me, something I was passionate about, to spend the rest of my life doing. And of course I came right back to Iditarod. And so then I decided to take on what I call Joe's commission. His virtual dying words 2 days before he passed to those who came to wish him goodbye at his behest. He had called race headquarters and asked for a couple of the guys to come down. Was, for the sake of Alaska and the dogs, promise me you won't let my race die. Well, I took that upon myself and called it Joe's commission, and linked arms with a couple of other guys, and I made myself a list I called Rob's Baker's Dozen. It turned out 13 points that I wanted to accomplish before I died that would help preserve the race. So two of the big ones were to write a book on how the Iditarod Trail came into being and write a book on how the race that runs over the trail came into being. So those are called, the books are named Trailbreakers, Pioneering Alaska's Iditarod, Volume 1 and Volume 2. So I accomplished some other things, but one of the things I did was I went downtown in Anchorage and I established a kiosk down there as what I just called my function, volunteer Iditarod ambassador to our summer visitors. And the main thing was, talking a very positive sled dog use narrative and educating, informing, entertaining our summer visitors. Over time, it quickly became the busiest non-food kiosk on Anchorage downtown streets. And over time, I've gone well past 100,000 walk-ups to the kiosk. And by the way, it started in 2009. I took 3 years off during COVID, but now I'm headed toward 150,000 total, you know, walk-ups to the kiosk there. They come to talk Iditarod and pet my big, beautiful Malamute, and we just hang out and have a good time. I would say that I probably, I don't want to flatter myself too much, but I probably have a handle, a better handle, on kind of the public, what would I say? Their moxie about the race, their knowledge of it, their awareness of it, all of that, than anybody else. I don't put on a program. Most of the people that have big numbers stop are putting on a program. So the drift of everything is going from these people to their guests. I don't have a program to put on. I just visit and I listen. So I get a really, really good kind of a capsule, I guess, on kind of the public mind regarding Iditarod.
So let me ask you a couple of questions so we can set the scene here. One on the musher side and then one on the public side. The first one is, we've talked a couple of times about the Finishers Club, and I know that that's still very exclusive. Of course, only finishers can be involved with that. How has that evolved over the last 50 years or so? Of course, as a finisher, you become a member of this club, but I'm sure over the years, you know, politics have been involved and rule changes and, you know, the race itself. How have you seen, if you've been involved with that club at all, how have you seen it develop in a positive and maybe even in a negative way?
It's been a very, very difficult thing to hold together and make function. At first, we didn't even envision people from outside coming to run the race. Mm-hmm. We were all Alaskans, and we were thinking that maybe we would gather three or four times a year, and we were thinking about kind of having it split up into regional sub clubs that would meet, and then once a year gather to meet regionally or statewide. And we just said no. But over time, I mean, it didn't take any time at all. We could see that there was no interest in getting that organized and that involved. And the meetings would come in Nome at the close of the Iditarod race. So, you know, you see some people are one and done. Some people run for a few years, they rise to the top perhaps, and then they fade out and quit. And it's just so much fluctuation in the membership. Over time, there have been a few people that have tried to take it upon themselves to kind of make the club function well as a club. But it's kind of like herding squirrels, and just a pretty thankless job. The Iditarod Trail Committee has pretty much allowed one member of the official finishers club to be on the committee, but I don't know how much that person has to say about anything today. Anyway, it's kind of a tough situation. I think if it were not for the internet, it would be really, really hopeless. I just wrote an email yesterday to some of the people that I have access to on the board, kind of cautioning them that the patch like the buckle, is to be given out only to those who have completed the race according to official rules. And I told them that they probably don't even know that the patch is registered legal property only of the Iditarod Official Finishers Club. It is not the property of the Iditarod Trail Committee. I turned distributing those patches over to the Iditarod Trail Committee decades ago because, again, the Official Finishers Club a lot of times just hardly worked. So it was logical for the Iditarod Trail Committee, the race administrators, to, you know, keep up a supply of patches and hand them out at the end of the race and hand them only to those who qualified. So anyway, I just reminded them that, or educated them, do not give these patches out to those who have not earned them the standard way. We don't want to have somebody come up to someone with a patch on their back and have to ask them, did you earn yours or did you buy it? So anyway, okay, that's pretty much IOFC content.
Yes, and I'm going to come back to that on your opinion of this expedition class in just a second, but I want to go back to the public and their perception of the race and all of that. You had mentioned that so many people come up to you and they say, hey, I'm very familiar with the Iditarod because I know Balto and Togo and, you know, I saw the movies and all of the things, right? We hear that every day from our listeners and our fans and our readers and all of that. But of course, we get visitors here in Anchorage and in Alaska from all over the world, and everybody has a different interpretation of sled dogs and, of course, of the Iditarod in particular. Besides that question about can you explain how the Serum Run is related, what are some common questions that people ask, and do they all leave much more educated? I'm sure they do by talking to you. Do they feel that they're much more educated when they leave your booth than just their interpretation from the media?
Oh, yeah. I make sure of that. that's funny. As you called to open this interview, I was writing to my friend Helen Hegener, who has this fantastic book coming out on how the Iditarod Trail came into being. So mine's more of a storyteller's version, and hers is very carefully researched. But anyway, I told her, and I'm just going to read this little tiny three lines. By the way, I quite some time ago saw such a chapter is needed, as every day without exception at my kiosk, I have to explain over and over that the primary inspiration for creation of the race in the first place was not the Serum Run, as the majority of my walk-ups think, but to save the working sled dog. By the way, I start out by asking them if they realize how, you know, what the inspiration for the race was, and that's how I get that answer. But anyway, I say, of course, most tourists, while not quite so distanced from the land as to not know milk comes from cows and eggs from chickens, are so urbanized they have pretty much no idea why each off-road household would need services of a dog team. The best example was long ago found to be how hopeless it would be to try to heat your cabin by carrying stove wood from a distant armload, armload by armload. So this is, of course, talking about pre-snow machine. And so I just find a tremendous naivete among the people who walk up. They don't understand village life. They don't understand life, you know, before mechanization out there, and have to be educated. But they really have their eyes open by the time they leave.
Yeah, and like I said, we get a lot of the same questions. But I guess to challenge that just a little bit, at least from my understanding, Rod, is when we bring it back to a story that they're very familiar with the story of the Serum Run and Balto and all of that, Leonard Seppala and all that they did leading up to the Serum Run, and of course, after, for many decades over. Don't you think that that is also a way of preserving the sled dog by telling that story and sort of lumping them together as this grand history of the sport and of the lifestyle?
Oh, absolutely. You know, as you know, the race originally, until just about 3 months before the takeoff of the first race, all the years leading up to it, the plan of Joe Reddington's was to go from Kinnick to Iditarod and return. So, you know, a little place that had dwindled from Gold Rush days to a few houses out in the bushes at the end of a dirt road, out to a ghost town that most even Alaskans had forgotten about, and back to the little spot in the bushes. So most people do not recognize the name Bill Weimer, but he is one of my five, if not twos, that I'm going to stress in this rewrite of my book. If not for, you know, Joe Reddington, there'd have been no race, for instance. If not for General Geddes, there'd have been no trail, so no race. But if not for Bill Weimer, who forced the vote that overrode Joe to his original, or, you know, first displeasure for at least a little while. By the time he got home, he was excited about it, but anyway, Bill Weimer forced the vote that caused the change to go from Anchorage to Nome. And I list in my books some of the great advantages that happened when that occurred. And holy smoke, that was, I call it in my chapter, The Golden Key. That so enriched the race. But one of the enrichments wasn't seen until a few years after the first races, and that was that when they reached the Yukon, they fell in over the footprints and runner tracks of the Serum Run. And so that has been wonderful. It just needs to be clarified that it was not the reason for the inspiration for the race. What happened is you could not buy advertising like that. Holy smoke, that false narrative just swept the world. And the committee is, you know, kind of staggered. What are we going to do with this? We don't want to throw this away. So what they did was, in a way, this kind of makes it more confusing and hard for people to parse. But what they did was saying, okay, that wasn't the original intent, but now we are changing and we're adding to the, you know, the pillars that created this race. And by the way, when the committee first started working to create the first Iditarod race, they had three written goals. Number one, to hold a race. Number two, save the sled dogs. Number three, get enough attention focused on this old forgotten Gold Rush trail that it could be added to the national trail system. And so what they did was they added one more, and that is and this is, again, several years after the first Iditarod, they added commemorate the Serum Run. So,
and that, anyway. And that's how they brought the histories together. Let's talk about, yeah, let's talk about your visitors. Of course, there's a huge generational shift. We see it in our coverage and in particular in our magazine. Old timers, meaning people older than me, I'm mid-50s right now, and older, have a very keen sense of history. Folks that are younger than I'm thinking my kids' age, they don't care as much about history as we did. They don't read as much as we did. They don't learn about history as much as we did. And I know that's a big basket to put folks in, but it's mostly true. They get all of their information in little snippets on social media, and then that's where they're getting their information. How are you attempting to bridge that generational divide? You know, the old timers, they get it, but the younger guys and gals, they may not. How do you do that? How do you bridge that gap, if you will, for folks that may not even care about history? They just want to know what's happening today in 30-second snippets.
Yeah. You know, mostly the people who stop at my kiosk are interested when I start to, give them my spiels and talk to them. The big key is that I ran the first Iditarod. They can hardly believe that, and that's always a great door opener. I was talking to a friend who with the Mushing District as we went around. He'd introduce me as Rod ran the Iditarod. I told him, Jim, that doesn't mean anything. It's not quite like dime a dozen, but there's 800 and some of them. Introduce me as Rod ran the first Iditarod. And so anyway, I do get a lot of interest in history. I totally agree with what you're saying about the lack of interest in general, and all this that you're saying about the effects of social media and lack of interest in history. I think a lot of our schooling, old time, American history, history of Western civilization, some of those subjects have been replaced with kind of more modernized subjects in a lot of our school systems. But anyway, one thing I do is when people start to ask about purchase of my first book about history of the trail, I ask them if they really enjoy reading. And a lot of people don't read much anymore. And also I dissuade people from buying that book for their little 8 or 10 year old kids. And I just tell them, one of these other books would be a lot better purchase for them. This is a history they won't probably be interested in. If they're like me, I really wasn't very interested in history until I grew up. But
yeah,
we do have a pretty rich interchange down there, really. I think part of it is that the old races had a lot more drama than today's races. Today, I mean, back then it was like the Mexican road race or Paris to Dachau, just all these crashes and wild and crazy happenings out on the trail and the tremendous characters we used to have that ran the race. And now it's pretty much kind of flat. It's like Kibble-fueled NASCAR over a manicured trail, and everybody starts out fairly young with the intent of becoming a professional Iditarod racer, and just kind of a lot of sameness to the participants, and that's nothing you can do about that. It's just kind of the difference in the old races and today.
And of course, right there, At your kiosk location is the start of the Ferrandi races as well. That's been going on for decades before the Iditarod started. And you're right. There were a bunch of colorful characters back in those days. We're thinking of, George Atla and Doc Lombard and Roxy Wright and all of those folks that ran in the other classes of races other than Iditarod. Let's jump up to that part of the story, Rod, with the Anchorage Mushing District. I know that is a relatively new thing in terms of the history of mushing in Alaska, with the arch and everything that's going on with that right there at that location. Can you briefly get our readers up to speed there? When did that first come to fruition? I know we've had Jim on our podcast before, and he kind of gave the history of it, so we don't need to repeat that. But maybe a year of when that started, where we are today, and what is the forecast in the next 3, 4, 5 years with that area as we're moving forward?
Yeah, you know, it started at a meeting of the Rondi people, and Susan Duck, the old head of the for Rondi Inc., mentioned, you know, Nome's got an arch. Why couldn't we have one? And so the whole thing started out all about an arch. And that's when I first heard about it. I remember giving a talk before I was on the board. I was giving a talk to the old downtown community council, and I was collared by a guy down in the lobby of the Anchorage Hotel after my talk, and introduced himself. It was none other than Tom Begich, who's now running for governor. And he and I went out on to the corner in the evening darkness there at 4th and E, and we stood for half hour, 45 minutes, just kind of rhapsodizing about what this arch would do for Anchorage. And we agreed it would be the tourist photo op mecca. My great question, greatest question of all during the years at the kiosk, is where is the famous starting line? And so I can forecast great crowds down there around that arch taking pictures. Well, it expanded from there with a fellow named Roger Brooks, who came up, and he was a city development expert known throughout the United States. And our community development people brought him up for his take on Anchorage. And he spent 2 or 3 years coming back and forth and analyzing things. And he said, you know, one of the greatest things that you can do for a city is find an area, especially maybe an old rundown area, but find something that you're famous for and develop a district about it. Well, all of a sudden it goes bingo to Jim and Roger McCleary, the head of Fur Rondi. Not just this arch at one place. Let's create this long district. So it's 7 blocks long, goes from A to G Street along 4th. And boy, oh boy, does that area have a history in sled dog use. I have created a 12-page booklet with the help of Helen Hegener and Buzz Rolfing and some friends that are graphic artists, one of which is Maria Tallis, creator of the arch. And this book is called Anchorage Was a Trail Town. And it shows how Anchorage in its birth, until the railroad functionally came through the first 2 or 3 years of Anchorage, nothing, once the inlet froze up and blocked inlet water traffic, nothing could flow in or out of this new burgeoning city except over the Iditarod Trail, either south to Seward or north into the interior. In the book, it shows all the dog team traffic, all the different uses for the dog team and so forth. One of the great pictures is of more than $100 million in today's gold prices on 4 sleds the trailing sled is right about 5 steps in front of where my kiosk is. And the biggest load they ever brought through was 3,400 pounds of gold towed by 46 old, old breed giant freighting huskies. And not sure how I got off on that topic, but.
Let me ask you a question about that. This is more of a tongue in cheek, but of course we all grew up on watching the old Westerns, you know, with the masked barons robbing the stagecoaches and all that. Was there any of that going on with all that gold going back and forth? Did we have any outlaws like we see in the old West?
The guy that headed up what they called the gold train for Wells Fargo had, I think, 42 offices in Alaska transporting the gold. Of course, they started out like Brinks and Loomis as guardians of the gold. They were called Wells Fargo Express before they were a bank. Anyway, Bob Griffiths, of course, was asked that question. He was an old Black Hills stagecoach driver, and he says, let them try.
Oh, my goodness.
He said, I was robbed a few times in the Black Hills. Well, I mean, think about it, Robert. Those some outlaws could tumble a boulder down off a bank or fall a tree across the stagecoach road and stop the coach. And then they step out and they've got a sawed off shotgun on the driver. And of course, he's going to hand down the strong bucks. They can ride off in any direction they want and go anywhere they want. While up here, as anybody that knows the nature of a trail knows, a winter trail, is you step one step off of the trail and you're in snow up to your neck. And there's one trail and you're in it. Now, if the guy's able to rob this gold, which is heavier than lead. And, you think I'm all the time at the kiosk, I'm demonstrating to people how, if I were doing it the way I would carry it, and it would be on these very thin oak steel bound boxes, and they would be tied down to the base of your load. And they'd stay there for the duration of the trip. Well, it would probably take about four men with rope handles on those boxes to get them into the sled. And now if you're robbing it, you either have to take the whole sled or you have to have a crew to get the gold out of one sled and into the other. And now
I'm sure that there is a dime store novel or something about this type of deal, this type of story for sure, whether it's fiction or not. It would make a cool old Western for sure. So, Rod, in terms of numbers, you had mentioned that you were part of those early meetings. You said standing out there envisioning an arch. What year was that? And where do we see this district in the next half decade or so?
Well, what we see now with the arch itself is only half built. What we decided in a board meeting a year ago or so was let's take a gamble that we will be able to collect the rest of the money. But with the money that we have collected so far, by the way, it started out maybe as a $250,000 project, but as the years went by, it grew and grew and the costs went up. It's closer to $1 million project. But what we decided is let's get the showy part of it up and then, raise public awareness. The media had always been asleep on it and not that many people were aware. So let's raise public awareness, and probably the money will be easier to come by to finish it. And also, that arch going up will kind of break trail for all of the other features of the Mushing District that will go up along this 7-block-long stretch. And as you can imagine, you've got all these agencies with all of their agency heads. And as one person that was Moxie in Washington, D.C. said, the worst word in Washington, D.C. is a four-letter word spelled T-U-R-F, TURF. And so everybody's got their job description and, their bean counting and all of the different rules and codes and regulations that stand in the way of anything else being wedged in. And if you're going to create a district with all these features, you've got to wedge in. Well, this arch is so spectacular. And again, it's only half done. It is going to be amazing when it's finished. But it breaks trail, and you can say, see, and they've got to see the advantage of this. It's It will be very quickly, because of the spread, because of Iditarod, news, and Iditarod. It just glitters around the earth. It will be Anchorage's internationally recognized architectural landmark. So in the vein of, say, the Eiffel Tower, when you see a picture of the Eiffel Tower, how split of a second does it take for your mind to say Paris? Same with Golden Gate Bridge, Statue of Liberty, Space Needle, and those architectural landmarks. So this will be Anchorage's, and what it takes is something unusual, not another skyscraper. You could see a picture of the Empire State Building, and you wouldn't be sure that it's the Empire State Building in New York, whereas you see the Statue of Liberty, you know. So this is going to be a wonderful thing for Anchorage. As you've probably noticed, a huge number of the pictures of the takeoff in Anchorage, the photographer was careful to include the arch in the picture.
Oh, yeah. And one of the pictures we posted on our social media that night where they lit it up the first time, just blew up on our social media pages. I think 100,000 views or something like that, just from that, split second photo. Speaking of which, and I want to make sure that we catch us up to present day before we go, Rod, you're very familiar with that area of Anchorage and the surrounding buildings and all of that, the goings on in that area of town. What do you think will happen to all of that? You know, you have a couple of boutique restaurants, you have a fur dealer here and there, you have a cafe and, some bars, and, that was a boom or bust area of Anchorage, especially during the oil days in the, in the 70s and 80s. That was a bustling part of town. Where do you think that's going to go and what that's going to look like in the next decade or two, moving forward with the help of the awareness of this district and all that?
Well, as I voiced to Jim Heddle when I first came on the board, or actually in the years before I came on the board and he and I were talking, my fear was that because of all these bureaucracies around town, that they would try to minimize the Mushing District. For instance, probably the next great expense will be a part that I've been placed in charge of, and that is creation of the historic signs that will go along the street. And these will be signs like you see in national parks and monuments and different places. They are expensive. They are vandal-proof, fire-proof, weather-proof, time-proof, everything. And they run, maybe $4,000 to $8,000 a sign. And so I hope to, my vision is for about 24 of them. Well, you run into, somebody saying, oh, we don't want them to be this way and that way because it'll be hard to clear the snow around them. And they put up, anyway, my hope is that we can just steamroll over all of those objections and create these wonderful, wonderful signs. One of our board members, Mel, has created a wonderful walking tour, and this thing is just gathering steam. It's in its infancy right now, but it will be wonderful. And so you can track along with a group, or you can go by yourself with your phone. And so that's coming. Of course, banners along the street, and I'm hopeful of some statues. One thing I'm hopeful of is not just a statue of Sepala and Togo, but that combined with signage, and Helen Hegner has suggested a mural, and make it a big serum run, kind of an interpretive educational station. So what I hope is that when you step into this district, you know you have stepped into a district, that it is unique and different from where you just crossed the street from outside of the district. I think one thing is this Alaska Long Trails project has been working its way along, and pretty much it's fairly doable from Seward, at least as far as Anchorage. But as this grows, you know, readers of Backpacking Light magazine, Backpacker magazine, Outside, and some of these magazines, they'll start to come in droves to walk this trail. Surveys have shown that when these people on, say, the Pacific Coast Crest Trail or the Appalachian Trail, and these, when they come to a town, and they come in to kind of replenish or take a little R&R, they spend more money than the average person on a package tour. And so there, the side trip into Anchorage needs to have something that draws them. And so we want this block, seven block stretch, to just be packed with history and just be a wonderful, wonderful drawing experience for these people.
And my point to that, Rod, is my wife and I, we do quite a bit of traveling. And when you think of a district, I'm thinking of areas like in Seattle with the Pike's Market, and there's a district in Denver and in Nashville and the Art Deco district in Miami. And, you know, every big town has an area very similar to this. And of course, you guys are doing your small part, you know, from the mushing side of things. But I think it's gonna literally take to move mountains to get something like what they have there. I don't know if Anchorage is willing to put forth the time, energy, money, effort to really make it world class. What do you think on that?
I think that you are right. To a great degree. You're not going to rip down all the buildings and create Alaska land on 4th Avenue. It's pretty much taken up with tar and cement, glass and steel, and it doesn't speak of Alaska, the last frontier, at all, except for the wonderful little log cabin visitor center. And I designed my kiosk to be made of spruce poles and, you know, canvas roof, and look kind of thematic. And I have been pushing for that plaza that I'm in, not to allow some cheap pop-ups like you would see at Saturday Market, you know, aluminum and yeah, you know,
tourist trap type stuff.
First of all, just to make that as thematic as you can, and kind of duplicate my sort of you know, log spruce pole semi primitive type look.
Yep.
And there isn't much of a chance to change the downtown like you would like to. I understand what you're saying, that creation of district over the last maybe two decades all over the Western world has been a big, big thing, kind of a restitching of the fabric. Yep. Of these downtown. Sometimes they even have taken on some rebuilds.
Yeah, and I'm thinking of Seattle in particular with all the work that they've done. Rod, yep. Last point on that is you are in a very interesting spot there on the corner. You have a very very nice Mexican restaurant there in your block there, and of course you have the Alaska Mint and all that. So definitely some cool spots right where you're at, and of course right across the street is the Rondi headquarters, so on and so forth. So let's go to today. And this is where we're going to talk a little bit about the race that's happening right now. And I'm sure you're very aware where my wife and I, we cover the Iditarod every night on our podcast. People listen all over the world. Close to 500,000 people each year listen to us. And they're following this year's race very closely. And in particular, all of the hubbub about the Expedition class. And this sort of comes full circle with our talk of the Serum Run and what Norman Vaughn did in his later days with his Serum Run expeditions and all that has happened with that. And here we are today at a crossroads, and at the media briefing downtown, Rob Urbach had said, this is a changing of Iditarod. This is, you know, this is the future of it. We don't know exactly how it's going to lay out, but we have to move it to the next step, is, you know, summarizing what he said. What are your thoughts? And I know sort of already the answer because you had mentioned it with the patch, but what are your thoughts about sort of the changing of the race to where we're at right now today, March 2026, and then moving forward into the next chapter, probably well after you're gone and I'm gone and, you know, into the future. Hopefully it continues on.
Yeah, I get where your drift here and agree with it. And I think what we have needed is some, I'll just come out and say it, PETA-proof sponsors. It's PETA-proof sources of money. This is, I think, a great innovation. I'm not sure where the cutoff should be. I don't know if it should be as little as $50,000, but I guess if you got enough of those guys together, you could fund the race to a great degree that way. I think this, I mean, this is pioneering. They're figuring out as they go how to do it. And I'm sure people like Jeff King, who's out there with one of the guys, will have a lot to say about it. And some of the other old timers, and you can really pretty much trust Jeff. It's going to be good information when he gives it. One thing that I saw that I thought was pretty short-sighted at first was when the Iditarod's official, you know, Iditarod.com website, where they give the places of the mushers, the times in and out. At first, they had the expedition mushers out there in front of the race and mixed right in with the rank and file competitive mushers. They had them without even so much as an asterisk that would direct your attention to something explanatory below. I think maybe they got input, or maybe they just wised up that this was confusing and it was detrimental. I mean, how would you like to be leading the race like Jesse Holmes and be listed as, third? So pretty soon they did take them out of that listing at the top and put them below the last Iditarod competitive musher in a class of their own. And what I think is needed is just a little, very, very simple, little paragraph that talks about kind of the parameters of these guys, and that they don't have to comply with the regular rules. They can change dogs. They have a pit crew. They have their own vet and all those logistics taken care of. They get plenty of sleep and so forth. But I think it's coming, and I really do think that it's a good idea. Here's what I have said. I think the current Iditarod Trail Committee, pretty much made up of non-mushers, people who have no real history with the race, they are a wonderful group, mostly of a very giving people of their time, and in this, they're good at the finances, exploring ways to fund this race, and they're good at logistics, but they're not good at preserving the culture. and the drama of the old races. There's been some babies thrown out with the bathwater before they ever came aboard. It's not some of this, the main one is not their fault. It's something that Dan Seavey, the late Dan Seavey, and I and Dick Mackey had wished we could talk to them about, but don't seem to get any traction to do so. And so that is to get rid some way, somehow, of the corralling rule and get the race worked back into the fabric of the villages. Right now, they can be observers. Maybe they can shovel crap and clean up after the mushers, and that's about all there is for them anymore. It didn't start out that way, but I could spend a whole one of your programs talking about this. But one thing that was expressed to Jesse Holmes last year by the person in charge of making the Iditarod filmed is, you guys aren't giving me any storylines. I think part of the natural progression of things, you get the trail so well marked, there's no losing the trail anymore. And I wouldn't suggest that you take those markers away so people can lose the trail. You go over the trail and you groom it and you regroom it and you regroom it. There isn't any, snowshoeing ahead of the race. People don't camp out anymore. I've told my tourists, it used to be, they're always asking me, what's the difference in today and the old days? And one of the differences, I say, don't hold me to this exactly. It's just to make a point. In the old days, it was 3 days between checkpoints. You had to camp out. In today's race, it's three checkpoints a day. Why would you camp out? One of the racers that I talked to down at my kiosk, I said, holy smoke, you're the most advanced person knowledge-wise that I have ever talked to in my years here. And he says, well, don't you know who I am? I said, no. And he introduced himself. Oh, yeah, I've seen your name in the list of competitors. He'd run 16 Iditarods. And he said he had never had his snowshoes out of his sled. And it had been about 8 years since he had even unrolled his sleeping bag.
Yeah. So, yeah, Rod, you had mentioned the camping on the trail. One of our moments in history segments the other day was, I'm spacing the name right now. It came from a Team and Trail issue where they said they were out looking for this guy who was a little bit behind schedule, and they found him hunting ptarmigan. And they quickly said, hey, bud, you got to get back in the race and continue on. And he jumped right back in and jumped to the lead. And, the rest is history there. One last question on this, and then we're going to close out, Rod. We talked about the history and folks today, whether they care or not. And with the expedition class and Shel Roeke coming in yesterday into Nome first, with Jesse's not even in yet at the time of this recording. If Jesse wins, it looks like he's going to. But do you think that the general public, not necessarily the fans, the diehard fans of mushing, do you think the general public really cares that it's an expedition class versus a race, or they just like the story of this dog team making it to Nome, back to that serum run story that we talked about, this dog team making it to Nome to save these folks. Do you think that they care about that romantic part of it compared to the race side? And do you think that that's a good thing or a bad thing just in the general public view?
Well, I just think it takes a slight amount of education to differentiate between the legitimate racers and the expedition class. And I think that should be done. I don't know. I think it just adds an interesting element as long as it's separated.
Yep.
I don't know. It's just everything is so much in its infancy. We'll have to see. What you don't want, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of questions this summer, is you don't want the expedition class sort of showing up the best racers we've got. You need to tell the story of why. Why is this guy coming in, you know, well more than a day ahead of currently the best racer on the planet? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I think it does need some explanation, but then, you know, I don't know where this is going. I don't know where this is going. You get this tremendously qualified couple of guys out front with Thomas Warner going along with Roki. And then at the very tail end of the pack, I haven't looked, but as far as I know, maybe you can clarify, the other expedition member was Days in back of the tail ender.
He pulled out, he pulled out in McGrath. They okay. said our expedition is done here. We did, you know, we did our 300 miles and this was our goal, you know, if you say, but yeah, okay. I think more than anything, Rod, as, sort of historians and storytellers of the race and the culture and the lifestyle, both you and I are in a very unique position to share that narrative. We try to do it every night on our podcast. You do it every day, in particular in the summer. There's not a lot of guys and gals like us, are there, that it is our job to tell these stories. I just don't, you know, the media comes and goes. They talk about it for 2 weeks in March and then we don't hear much about it.
Right, right. No, I have mentioned to Jim Heddle and some of the guys with the Mushing District, when I'm gone, there will be no way to replace what I am doing right now. There is no one left that goes all the way back, not only to the first race, but before the first race, and can tell the entire story. But they will have to replace me. You look at what they do in national parks and monuments with these guys rotating, you know, 1 year they're in Great Smoky National Park and the next year they're in Denali and they have to learn a narrative. So, it won't be quite as rich, but there will be, a historical interpreter in place. I'll go as long as I can. I kind of get tired of giving up my summers with my family every year. And so at some point, you know, I may just say, well, you know, the last few years of my mobile life, I should get out and kind of take my grandkids and my kids and wife around Alaska.
Well, with that, Rod, to end the show here, speaking of road trips, we talked about, you munching on jalapeno peppers on a road trip, and in terms of posterity or whatever the word is there, hey, you've told one hell of a story here on this podcast series. Well over 4 hours of recordings of, I'm sure you've told a lot of these stories before, but I think you're going to reach an audience that has, number one, never traveled to Alaska, number two, are just the bare bones historical fans of the sport and of Iditarod. So I think you've really captured those folks, and that was my intention to have you on for this series. Typically, you know, we have somebody on, we speak for 20 minutes, and you know, we never speak to them again. So it has been my pleasure and my honor to have you on for this amount of time to share these stories and to preserve them as best as we can. I think that is very important to do. Rod, before we close, is there anything else that you would like to say or to talk about? And then we'll close the show.
Yeah, I think, first of all I am is a voice to your, you know, to your folk there. What they might do to put a face to that is Google four words, Antiques Roadshow Iditarod Sled. and they will see me on national public television with what has to be the most famous dog sled in the world.
Okay.
So there have been dog sleds along with mushers who have been interviewed and along with dogs who have been featured, but the sled itself has never been featured before. And here's my sled from the first Iditarod. At the time when I sent in the information to the show, I thought it was the only one preserved, but then quickly found out that Dan Seavey's was in the museum down in Seward. But they said, because of the uniqueness, they placed an appraised value on it were it to come up for auction, $20,000 to $30,000, advised I insure it for at least $40,000. So there's that sled from the first Iditarod. If you read my book, it'll talk about how much trouble it gave me. And anyway, they'll be able to see me and put a face to this interview.
So that is not the sled, going back to the story early in this episode, that's not the sled that you and Leroy worked on.
No.
Okay.
That's my 73 sled on the road show. It was my a big freight sled that I built. That's 13 feet long from the tip of the brush bow to the runner tails. That's a big freight sled that I built to come out from Minchumina in 1977.
Yeah.
By the way, that sled is at my kiosk
Each
summer.
Yes, I was going to mention that.
You've seen it, Robert.
Yep,
I've seen it.
I've seen the repair that you talk about. And if you do stop by, right there on the corner, you will see Rod and his sled and his kiosk right there, very close to the arch. And we're going to put a bunch of links here on this show notes page to your books and all of that, so folks can learn more about it for sure. Rod, it has been a pleasure. Stay on with me for just a second before we end here. On behalf of my guest over the last four episodes, Rod Perry, this is Robert for the Mushing Podcast. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.